I'm Steve Forrester, and my guest is Oregon's junior United States Senator Jeff Merkley. Welcome to After Deadline, Senator.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Good. Let's start our conversation with the election. You, of course, are working for President Obama's election. Did Mitt Romney's selection of Paul Ryan to be a vice presidential candidate help or hurt the Republican ticket?
Oh, I think it hurt it. I must say that the vision that Ryan has laid out in his budget plan is one that is all about making the 1% better off and more powerful and leaving the 99% behind. And I don't think that's the message that Americans are interested in at this moment.
Okay.
Or any moment, for that matter.
Yeah. Candidates are going to talk far more about other topics in this election, but we still have an army of occupation in Afghanistan. You've been very outspoken about the need to leave Afghanistan. Is the army leaving quickly enough?
Well, not quickly enough. I do applaud the president that he moved up the date for combat troops to come out from the end of 2014 to the end of 2013. He did that after the Senate adopted an amendment that I had put forward that instructed the president to increase the timetable for withdrawal, to get out faster, and to provide reports back to Congress on it. That amendment, though it passed the Senate, never made it to the president's desk, but at least it sent him a message that the Senate had moved a tremendous distance in terms of its support for getting out of Afghanistan.
What was the vote on your amendment? What kind of level of support did you get?
So it was done as a voice vote, and it was very interesting because the previous year, when Feingold had led an effort on an amendment, there had been 18 votes in favor, and I thought we might hit 40, 45 votes, but I could tell the momentum was really coming our way. John McCain got up, denounced my amendment, and then came over to me and said, let's adopt it. And so we did.
What caused his change of heart?
Well, I don't think his heart changed. but I think he was in contact with a lot of his Republican colleagues whose hearts had changed and realized that we were probably going to actually win the vote.
Yeah.
So if we're going to win the vote, he probably wanted us to win it on a voice vote rather than a recorded vote.
Understood, where they didn't all have to put their names on the vote.
Right.
Yeah. If you've just joined us, my guest is Senator Jeff Merkley. Let's talk for a minute, Senator, about your housing plan. You launched it a few weeks ago. Sum it up for our listeners.
Well, this plan is called Rebuilding American Home Ownership, and it's all about providing families with the chance to refinance, families who are underwater. That is, they owe more than their home is worth. There are about 11 million families in that category, so many, many millions across America. Of that group, the large majority are current on their payments. They have good credit. They have made the payments on high interest loans or thick and thin. But if they could pay at a lower rate, they'd be much less likely to default, and we'd help interrupt this cycle of defaults, keeping the price of housing down. And the extra income they'd have month to month would do a wonderful thing, either both for the family and for the broader economy. So it's something that could really help put the economy, our economy, back on its feet.
What kind of response are you getting?
Well, it's been a very positive response. Here in Oregon, we have so many parts of our economy that are connected to housing. Lumber, of course, but also grass seed and nursery stock and insulated doors and windows and the production of roofing shingles. And certainly, I've had the reaction. I had a Nobel laureate, Joe Stiglitz, and Mark Zandi, who is the chief economist for Moody's Analytics, they did an article saying that this is the plan. This is what we should do. We should do the Merkley plan. And so I've been pushing the administration. I'm hoping we can set up some pilot projects. I'd like to see a full-fledged effort underway. It could be done tomorrow by the Federal Reserve. They already have the authority to buy mortgages and mortgage-related products. So it could be done very, very quickly by the Fed, or it could be done more slowly through pilot projects and a broader plan.
And is this is something that could be done administratively without an act of Congress?
Yes. Through the Fed, it could be done immediately. It could be done through pilot projects using TARP funds immediately without additional legislation. If it was done on a full scale directly through setting up a trust, and then it would have to – we would need additional legislation to do it.
Okay. On the campaign trail, healthcare is a topic. The candidates talk a lot about Medicare these days, especially since Congressman Ryan has become the vice presidential candidate. of the Republican Party. How do you deconstruct the set of charges and countercharges between the Romney-Ryan and Obama-Biden tickets?
Well, at its simplest, what the Ryan plan is to create a basic payment to seniors, and the seniors could use that payment to buy insurance. And that disconnects Medicare costs from the inflation in the healthcare world, which means that we will be shifting the burden massively onto our seniors to provide for healthcare. That is a vision that completely demolishes the premises of Medicare, which is that in our senior years, we should be able to have a basic health care program available to every single American. I think that this is a debate that it's good to have out on the table and to be having. I can tell you I'm going to certainly be fighting to make sure Medicare keeps with its original vision.
The fight for control of the U.S. Senate took an interesting turn this week with an incendiary remark about rape by Todd Akin, the Republican candidate for senator in Missouri. Are people writing Akin's political obituary too soon?
Oh, I think they probably are. I think it's going to be a very close race in Missouri. Claire McCaskill is working very hard. There's many ups and downs in the course of a campaign. And while this remark, which was basically that women who have been raped do not naturally carry a baby to term, if you will, was so far off the mark, so completely insensitive and inaccurate as to raise questions about the Akin's judgment in many ways. But he has quite a bit of time between now and the November election to try to get his bearings again.
How, in general, how does the how do the races for the Senate look this year to the Democratic Party?
Well, if you start off, you see a trade across the aisle. That is, Maine probably comes in the Democratic camp. Nebraska probably goes in the Republican camp. And apart from that, there are nine races that are within single digits. But in terms of defending their seats, there's only one Democratic seat. Which the incumbent is not leading, or until recently has not been leading, and that's Claire McCaskill's seat. And there are several seats, other seats, that Democrats have a chance to pick up, one being Massachusetts and one being Arizona. And so I think there's a good probability that the Democrats will end up somewhere between 52 and 54 seats.
Okay. This is After Deadline, and my guest is Oregon United States Senator Jeff Merkley. A minute ago, we talked about Medicare and on entitlements in general, Senator. Ryan, of course, is not the only person who talks about a need to reconfigure certain aspects of Social Security, shall we say, or Medicare in the future. But there's quite a variance, of course, on what people say next. And how do you size up Social Security in the future? What is the need for a change there in terms of the date at which people can collect it or various other ideas that have been floated?
Yes, in terms of Social Security, we need to realize there is a trust fund that has been building up as baby boomers have been paying into it. Then the whole plan was that those funds would then be paid out as they retire. Right now, the point at which that trust fund gets back to zero is about 25 years into the future. And at that point forward, the models say that basically you could continue paying 70% of the benefits indefinitely with the income that would be coming in under the current structure. So the question is, how do you take that 25-year horizon and make it a 75-year horizon? In other words, get over the complete total baby boom demographic and have the program fully intact. And I think probably the best strategy is to raise the ceiling on the amount of income that is subject to the Social Security tax. It has been raised over time. It's now somewhere about $108,000. And opening up that to a higher level extends the horizon considerably.
Senator, you're two-thirds of the way through your six-year term. What's the biggest surprise or the biggest lesson you've learned?
I'll tell you, the biggest surprise was how dysfunctional the U.S. Senate is. If you want to have an experience that makes the Oregon legislature look fully professional and fully competent, spend a few days in the U.S. Senate. It has become so paralyzed by partisanship and by maneuvering around ancient rules that are stretched and abused in ways that were never intended, that it really is lost the ability to debate and decide, which is the heart of the legislative process. This is why I'm spending a lot of my time working on issues related to the reform of the rules and the procedures of the Senate.
Will the Senate change eventually?
I think actually there's a very good chance the Senate will change. The proposal that I put forward a year ago, January, had 46 senators in support of it. And one of those that didn't support at the time was Inouye, Senator Inouye of Hawaii. He has now said he's supporting changing the rules. Another person who didn't support it was Senator Reid, the majority leader. He has now said he's going to support some form of change. The important thing is that the change be done in such a way that is fair to the minority and the majority. The majority wants to be able to get to a final vote. The minority wants to be able to present amendments and make their case. Both those should be accommodated in a process of fair debate and decision making. And quite frankly, when it's done well, various ideas will get adopted from both sides of the aisle into a final product. So if we can get away from amendments simply being a way to put the other side on edge with developed campaign material, if you will, and actually get into a problem-solving mode, it would be wonderful for the institution and be wonderful for America.
The energy picture seems to be changing with the promise of natural gas through an extraction process called fracking. What's your view of that process and the prospect of huge movements of natural gas across the country as a result?
Well, currently fracking is exempt from the Clean Water Act, which has meant that there's a lot of mystery around exactly what ingredients are pumped into the ground and how much damage is done to water tables. I think that as it becomes part of the mainstream production of energy, it needs to be carefully regulated. So it's done in a manner of which it doesn't do damage to our water supplies around the country. It does hold enormous potential for increased gas production. That's good for global warming because it produces less global warming gases, less carbon dioxide for the amount of energy. It's certainly good for America in terms of our energy independence.
This summer, with the widespread drought, has caused a certain amount of alarm and seems to be, if not reopening, at least reconfiguring the debate or discussion about climate change and global warming. What's your perspective on that?
I have been surprised time and time again how easy it is for people to ignore what's going on in the world. If you look to the north, you see the Greenland ice sheet melting. You see the Arctic ice sheet melting. In fact, the whole conversation about exploring and drilling in the Arctic is because the Arctic sheet is retreating so much. You see the permafrost starting to melt in these what are called drunken forests, where the trees stagger in every direction as the permafrost melts. Here in the ocean, we see much higher carbon dioxide levels and acidification starting that has an impact on sea life. Everywhere you look in the globe, there is an impact of the changing temperatures. And the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, pre-industrial age, was about 270 parts per million. Now we're talking about hitting 400. In short order, we'll hit 400 parts per million, beyond the level where it is easily possible to kind of stabilize the chemistry of the air that wraps our planet. That chemistry is so important to the future. It is irresponsible for folks not to pay attention to how the air is changing and its impact on this planet, and to work together to find ways to reduce our consumption of carbon, our burning of carbon, to increase our production of carbon-free electricity. We can have economic development, and we can have a much better strategy in terms of the environment. In America, you can combine what is good for our independence, that is our economy, our national security, and our environment all work in the same direction.
The Eugene Register Guard recently published an editorial drawing attention to a former climate change or global warming skeptic, I've forgotten the scientist's name, who has really changed his attitude and said it is real, it is happening. From your perspective, of course, in the Senate, you see the whole spectrum of science come before you and so forth. Do you sense that there's a shift going on among such people?
No, I don't sense such a shift. That scientist did several things. One thing that he did was a very careful study of the impact of sunspots, because that's often used as an explanation. Another thing that he did is he took all of the urban thermometers basically out of the models, because there's been the argument that thermometers or temperature sensors that are in urban areas because of the amount of concrete and pavement are artificially inflated, and therefore, so he took those out of the model. He took on every single explanation that's been forwarded and basically tested it. And out of that came, my goodness, when I pull all those factors out, the basic fact remains that the temperature is steadily increasing.
Yeah. But you do not see many joining him.
No, I don't see many folks joining him. What I see are the Koch brothers, who have vast oil and coal interests, spending enormous sums. And in this super PAC world, this is a world where they carry enormous clout. And in fact, this takes us to the heart of one of the biggest problems for our democracy. The first three words of our Constitution are "We the people." But what super PACs do is make government about "we the rich and powerful." And this is very evident in this debate over global warming.
Now, in response to the super PACs, which the Supreme Court enabled with its decision in the Citizens United case, you and some others put forward, I think, an amendment to the Constitution regarding that. How's it going?
It's not going well. It has a modest amount of support in the Senate and very little support in the House. I also teamed up with a group to put forward a revised Disclose Act, and we trimmed all sorts of things out of it, the original act, which had failed by one vote to overcome a filibuster. And take down just the simplest of issues, which was this: any donation to a political entity over $10,000 has to be disclosed. So if you see an ad on television or on radio or in the newspaper that says it's by the Coalition for Blue Skies, you could look up online and see every major donor to that cause, and at least know where are these folks coming from, what is their real interest. Disclosure was supposed to be kind of apple pie. During the McCain-Feingold debate over campaign finance, which put limits on individual donations, so many folks went to the floor and said, "Well, I'm not for limits, but I'm for disclosure. That's the sunlight. That's the disinfectant. That's what keeps everyone honest. That's the right of American citizens to know." And yet the folks who went to the floor and made those comments, they voted against disclosure not once, but now four times. And it is a huge threat to democracy to have these vast pools of dark campaign money floating around, and putting everyone basically, you never know when you're going to get hit from where, by whom, and you never will know by whom. And that also creates enormous leverage during the political process itself. You're sitting there, my colleagues are sitting there during debates, and they're thinking, yes, I want to shut down these oil amendments, these loopholes that give oil companies $5 billion a year that they just put in the bank. Well, then they think, well, yeah, is that super PAC going to come after me if I do that? And that's so corrupting and corrosive to the process of developing good policy that I can't see how the Supreme Court could possibly continue to hold the position that it said in Citizens United, which there is no corrosive or corrupting influence by unlimited anonymous campaign donations.
Were you surprised by the Supreme Court's decision in the health care case this year, the Affordable Health Care Act?
I was surprised in that I thought they probably would throw out the individual mandate. I had sat in on one day of the Supreme Court argument, and I had found it completely fascinating. They were debating whether or not if the federal government provides a generous match rate on Medicaid, is that generosity so substantial that it amounts to coercion and therefore is illegal? And it was I'd never heard an argument of that nature before, and it seemed the argument went in circles. I found myself wanting to jump up and join the argument and really try to kind of take it down the course of at what point does federal assistance to a state become so generous that it becomes coercive. And try to nail down the principles behind that, but I of course as you're sitting there you don't get to participate, you get to listen, but as I heard how much sympathy there was for that point of view, I thought this conversation could go any possible direction here that could be quite unexpected, but I did think the mandate would probably be tossed.
Is it shall we say too late for the Republicans to repeal the Affordable Health Care Act?
This is the fascinating thing, which is that if you take the pieces of the Affordable Care Act, many of the Republican colleagues support those pieces because their citizens support it. If you break it down into the piece of the act which is focused on training more doctors and nurses, you're going to find people who say, well, I'm opposed to the act, but keep that program to train doctors and nurses because our doctors and nurses are retiring. And then if you take the part of the act that focuses on prevention, you're going to see folks say, well, get rid of the act, but wait, not the part that focuses on prevention. And then you're going to have folks who say, well, get rid of the act, but not the part that creates a market place so families can compare policies and there'll be more competition between private companies. And this will go on and on in this fashion. It turns out that the individual elements are enormously popular, including the reforms of insurance company abuses, where folks had insurance and when they got sick, they're thrown off their insurance, or they have pre-existing condition and they can't get insurance, or there's gender discrimination. And so I think that what is not well understood is if it came to a debate and you take the pieces, there will be broad bipartisan support for keeping basically the major elements of the bill.
Well, and meanwhile, the states have responded. Many of the states have responded, Oregon being one, where Governor Kitzhaber has sought waivers in some cases and then is preparing CCO, community care organizations, and there's going to be one over here, I gather. To where a lot of machinery would have to be stopped and reversed.
Yes, I really praise Governor's leadership on this because Oregon stepped out in front. I weighed in with Secretary Sebelius, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, to work to get the upfront funds necessary for the cooperative care Medicaid model to go forward. So the administration became convinced that this was a wonderful example to find out if some of the principles in a very different way of delivering care could work under the leadership of someone with a medical background. So Oregon has a chance to test out a very different system and to share the results with the country, and that will be of enormous service not only to the citizens of the state but to the rest of the nation in terms of what we learn from it.
Let's talk about student loans for a second. It's been getting a lot of discussion and ink recently with at least some commentators and certainly students and parents noting that some of the burdens that students are leaving college with are the sort of thing they're never going to pay off in their lifetime probably. Do you see a consensus emerging that would build support for dealing with that?
I don't see a consensus building at this point. There's an acknowledgement that the cost of higher education is way too high. If you look at the average wage, inflation adjusted, of a working family, it's been flat since 1974, the year I got out of high school. And over the last 10 years, it's actually gone down about 7%. So people see the middle class world slipping away from them. Meanwhile, the cost of college tuition has been anything but flat. It way outpaced in inflation. So a lot of students are thinking, I really will never be able to afford to go to college. And once they think that way, their motivation in high school becomes less. I'm looking into an idea that was presented in committee by someone who said that it was a pilot project that they designed but hadn't been able to get funded, where you would sit down with students at the start of high school and lay out and make a guarantee of what sort of aid is available if they maintain a good grade point average, and to see if this type of commitment would substantially improve high school performance and preparation, and the student laying the plans and following those plans to get more education, to contribute to our economy, and to have a good prospects for their own life. I think that is important for students to know this path, that there is a ladder they can climb. That the rungs aren't so far apart. It's not so difficult. It's not so impossible that they just give up. That's very destructive for individuals and for our broader economy.
You went to Stanford University as an undergraduate. And did you have help doing that?
I sure did. I was the first in my family to go to college. And I essentially went to Stanford by accident. I asked a vice principal at my school, where if she was me, where would she apply? And she named three schools, and Stanford was one of them. And of those three schools, one application arrived late, so I didn't apply. And of the other two, Stanford gave me the most aid. So sight unseen, down I went. Coming from a working class family, it was an enormous culture shock to go into a setting where people had thought about college their whole life, their families had been very familiar with it. But it was such an opportunity to learn all kinds of things, my curiosity about the world in all kinds of directions.
Changed your life.
But the thing that made it possible for this working class kid to go was the financial aid package that came with that letter. I don't know which I was more excited about, the fact that one, I'd gotten in, or second, that the aid made it clearly possible for me to go.
You're one of not many senators, I dare say, who had a working class upbringing.
There are very few of us, and this is a problem for democracy, because you can see it among my colleagues. Those who were raised in bubbles of wealth really aren't familiar with how the bulk of America is being impacted by the type of economy we have now, where we're losing manufacturing jobs. We've lost 5 million manufacturing jobs in the last 10 years. Well, if you're familiar with kind of the foundation of middle class wages, manufacturing is hugely important. If we don't make things in America, we are not going to have a middle class in America. But when colleagues have been involved in a kind of a bubble of wealth, they may never really kind of register. They may register academically, but maybe it doesn't register in their heart.
It also seems from afar that Washington, D.C. has become a place quite different from the rest of America during this recession because of war contracting and other money coming in back there. It's not suffered the way that economy back there has not suffered the way the rest of the country has.
No, that's true. Just to take housing, for example, the price of housing has fallen very little and has probably rebounded back to where it was. I must say, as I've talked to other senators about my housing plan, a couple have said, well, now, my house is underwater. Would this help me? And immediately, when they have a personal involvement, suddenly they understand the issue.
Yeah.
And this goes to my point about how important it is to have senators come from a variety of backgrounds in order for members of the body, sufficient members of the body, to understand the issues that we're facing as a nation.
Right. Well, Senator Jeff Merkley, thanks for being with us today on After Deadline.
It is an absolute pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
After Deadline is a joint production of The Daily Astorian and Coast Community Radio.